Hall & Wilcox acknowledges the traditional custodians of the lands on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to all First Nations people joining us today.
Welcome to our latest episode in our Building Better Boards podcast, where we examine the key issues facing boards and executive leaders. I'm Susie Leask, partner in our corporate and commercial practice and co-lead of our Beyond Compliance initiative. There are so many complexities facing boards and their organisations now, and it is vital that leaders are equipped to minimise these risks. In today's episode, we're going to discuss how to build legally compliant, healthy and inclusive organisations. I'm delighted to be joined by my colleague, Faye Calderone, who is a partner in our National Employment and Workplace Relations team and a highly regarded employment lawyer. Welcome, Faye.
Hi, Susie. Nice to be here with you again.
So much to talk about, I think, on today's podcast, and it's almost a question of where to start and how do we cover it in the time we've got. We see so many organisations that need to undertake transformational cultural change to move beyond that box-ticking compliance to become diverse and healthy and inclusive and respectful workplaces. But how do you do that?
Well, it's interesting because we always have framed our conversations as being beyond compliance conversations from particularly when we are talking about discrimination and sexual harassment in the workplace, and the fact that building a diverse and inclusive organisation that, you know, isn't dominated by homogenous groups, where you do have people that are representative of particular, you know, broader groups within the community, that they are properly participating and contributing and feel valued and can bring their true selves to work. All of those things have been important conversations as part of our Beyond Compliance framework. But as the law has changed recently, they are increasingly becoming also important conversations to ensure compliance with the proactive duty that employers now have. And it's more than employers, it's persons conducting business or undertaking. A lot of the boards and executives would be familiar with that term from a work health and safety point of view. But there's a positive duty to eliminate as far as possible sexual harassment, sex discrimination, sex-based harassment, victimisation, and also organisations or workplaces that are hostile on the grounds of sex. And the only way we can really do that is by starting to look at leadership and culture and a lot of the proactive compliance obligations that we'll talk about today. But it really is necessary that you have healthy and inclusive workplaces that are safe. And in fact, that's the consistent language through the guidelines and the reports and the, you know, how-to guides for employers that have been released by the Australian Human Rights Commission make it very clear that these intersectional issues and these broader high watermark issues are now quite necessary in order to discharge the proactive duty that employers now have.
And you're right, it's such an important conversation, and certainly from a risk and compliance perspective and going beyond compliance as leaders in organisations, it's so critical. But let's touch on the respect at work legislation, because this concept, these words have been splashed all over the media for years now. Can you give us a rundown on what's changed recently and what this means for leaders in business across Australia?
Sure. It's been a big couple of years for the Sex Discrimination Act and the Australian Human Rights Commission. Every 4 years, the Commission used to run a report and survey workplaces to understand the prevalence of sexual harassment in the workplace. And the results consistently were not good in terms of our national scorecard, and even the most recent results indicated that 33% of respondents to the survey had been sexually harassed in a workplace in the last 5 years. the more concerning thing is our most vulnerable people in our communities, like people that have a disability, our Indigenous populations, our people in insecure work. They are the most vulnerable, our low-paid workers, and so it's there are intersectional issues at play, and certainly, you know, precisely the opposite of what we're talking about, which is creating, you know, diverse, inclusive, healthy workplaces. As a result of that, the Australian Human Rights Commissioner at the time, Kate Jenkins, had made 55 recommendations, or with her team, in a report, which was called the Respect at Work Report. And those recommendations were focused on, you know, changing the tide and finally addressing sexual harassment in the workplace as a significant issue, and ensuring employers are proactive in the way that they, and I say employers, I should say PCBUs, but for ease of reference, forgive me when I slip up, are more proactive in the way that they address it in the workplace. Now, those 55 recommendations, some of them were implemented by the Morrison government, which was initially in government when the report came out, and that included things like recognising that sexual harassment is a valid reason for termination under the Fair Work Act, that it constitutes serious misconduct under the Fair Work Act, and also extending the applications for orders to stop bullying to sexual harassment that was occurring in the workplace for employees. It was more narrowly defined at the time. It's recently been extended to contractors. So someone that is being sexually harassed at work can make an application to the Fair Work Commission and seek orders if they can persuade the commission that it's continuing, it's likely to continue, to stop bullying. Breach of those orders is a civil penalty provision. Similar provisions apply in relation to bullying. Now, that was where that Morrison government stopped with the changes, and they stopped short of implementing the recommendation in relation to the positive duty on the basis that there was already a positive duty in the work health and safety legislation, to the extent that they recognised, which was great, that sexual harassment is a serious work health and safety issue. They said the work health and safety legislation has the work to do there. The latest tranche of changes, which actually came in December 22, but enforceable from December 23, which is why it's now a very hot topic. Rubber's hit the road in terms of compliance. Basically fill the gaps in terms of those recommendations, and now employers have this positive duty, or positive persons conducting business or undertaking have this positive duty to eliminate, as far as reasonably possible, discrimination, sex-based harassment, which is not necessarily sexual harassment, victimisation, and workplaces that are hostile on the grounds of sex. And if they don't do that, the Australian Human Rights Commission has enforcement powers, and they can come in, undertake inquiries, issue notices, compliance notices, and they can go off to court and enforce those notices.
So these basically, are some huge changes.
Basically, yeah, we've gone from a complaints-based system to, you know, a proactive compliance system, putting a, you know, fence at the top of the hill rather than an ambulance at the bottom, which puts the onus on complainants.
Yeah,
sorry,
it's extraordinary,
isn't
it?
Really, really long answer, but it was a lot to cover.
It's a really big piece of legislation though, right, isn't it? And I think that's the point is, and I know for a lot of my business clients and leaders in business, it's almost overwhelming. And a lot of them, I think, don't know where to start because, you know, you've just summarised it, and I appreciate there's many more complexities to it than we have time for.
Yeah.
And you've done a great job of distilling that down. But I wonder, from a business owner and a business leader perspective, what steps practically should leaders put in place to ensure compliance with this new concept of positive duty, which does, as you say, seem to put the onus really back on the employer?
Yeah, there's a lot that can and should be done. And if we can distill it into some basic principles. I think policies and procedures are, of course, critical. We need to tell people what they must not do and what the consequences of not doing that, and the fact that the legislation is there and they're expected to comply. That's really, really important knowledge management and conversation to have with workers. It's also really important to have really good grievance management policies. We've seen many over the years that say, oh, if you want to make a complaint, you must do this and you must do that and you must fill out this 24-page form, and unless you've done that, you haven't made a complaint. Well, a lot of that's out the door now, and the
times have changed.
Yeah, anonymous. They can be. We need to have real trauma-informed practices when it comes to complaint resolution. Complainants need to have agency. I appreciate there's complexity there to the extent that you're also trying to provide. Undertake an investigation and make findings and provide procedural fairness to a respondent, but it is a careful balancing act. We need to ensure that there is training from a board level in terms of understanding their obligations to the executive level in turn, and then to line managers. I think we spoke in the last session, and we share this view that our line managers and ops people are our first responders on the scene. They really need to understand, what to do if a complaint comes to them, how to respond, and, who to go to. Our HR and investigation teams or legal teams, whoever is looking at the complaints, need to be really well versed and have quite specific training on trauma-informed practices to ensure that they're doing the right things and ensuring they're satisfying, helping us satisfy our obligations. And of course, our entire workforce needs to be trained in relation to these duties. The bystander action is critical for cultural change. Leaders can't be everywhere all the time. We need people doing the right thing when no one's watching. That standard you walk past is the standard you accept. Conversation is really powerful and necessary, I think, in order to really ensure compliance with the duty. There's a lot, but the other thing is that it's really important to know, and one of the biggest challenges my clients are facing is the issue around third party involvement. Now you probably
people
haven't
coming yeah. into the workforce, I imagine.
That's
customers,
right.
clients,
in our,
suppliers.
In our game, it's clients, it's barristers. Mm. In in retail, hospitality, it's all the clients and
the people
all of
you
those.
Don't control, right?
You can, yeah.
You, not well, that you control your
not
employees,
you cannot
but you
control
know what I mean.
it's a little bit harder. You can't discipline them in the same way. So there's signs that you can now get aside from putting terms into contracts, sign-on sheets, having charters with clients. It depends on your workforce and the nature of, your client base
industry,
and the nature of your interactions with the public. But it's as simple as, having signs up that say, the law has changed. Everyone has the right to feel safe and be treated respectfully. We won't tolerate sexual harassment. And if you engage in offensive or intimidating or inappropriate behaviour, you're not welcome here. That's literally what the, one of the standard signs I've seen and worked on with a client says. But you can't go through a McDonald's drive-thru nowadays without saying that, we love our customers and, thank you for your,
patronage.
That's the word I was looking for.
Yes.
But, we will not tolerate disrespect. So,
which is a powerful leadership message as well, right? I think about that a lot from, the bystander effect perspective. And when you are in a position where, you can stick up for other people, I think that's really, really important, and to set the tone and in terms of what's, tolerated or not tolerated, as the case might be. Gosh, it
exactly.
just seems like a minefield of different areas. And you mentioned before, this is a safety issue as well as a pure employment law, leadership, respect at work issue. So how does these new laws, how do they interact with the work health and safety obligations?
It's you need to comply with both. And of course, we know that, you know, safety is where the serious risks are for directors and officers and organisations in terms of big fines, criminal penalties, you know, for individuals. And so there is that duty to ensure the health and safety of workers and others in the workplace. And so to the extent that there is serious issue, serious sexual harassment claims, or any sexual harassment claims or a sexually hostile workforce, that is known to be a psychosocial hazard. We deal sadly in, you know, sort of on in a spectrum of matters, and you know, we have matters at the moment that are sitting with the police for investigation because they have crossed into assault territory, which is you know, really challenging and equally like a very serious safety issue. But the codes, Safe Work Australia has released a model code of practice, which rest of the states have now implemented in terms of the elimination of psychosocial hazards in the workplace. Sexual harassment is absolutely included and defined as a psychosocial hazard. And there's another code of practice, say in New South Wales, for the elimination of gender-based violence and harassment, also a safety code of practice. So
the law's really stepped up here, hasn't it? Oh, when you think about heaps. We used to talk physical safety, and now it's mental health and well-being as well at that psychological level.
Yeah, and there's task forces. I mean, one of my comments initially when the positive duty wasn't introduced was that, you know, who's going to be doing these investigations with the regulators? Are they going to be the same people that are, you know, investigating the mine explosion or the construction fatality? No, answer is they have task forces in place. Now, in New South Wales alone, and I know because many of my clients are getting knocks on the door, there are 300, as I understand it, extra boots on the ground looking only at psychosocial hazards in the workplace.
There's going to be that element of compliance and enforcement action proactively.
Exactly. And from it's really important also to note that the guidelines in relation to compliance with this duty, one of the, you know, some of the main really important things for businesses to do that they have not been doing up until now, or many haven't been doing up until now, is there's an obligation to consult with the workplace about sexual harassment issues. There's an or with these broader, you know, umbrella of terms that we've been talking about, there's an obligation to undertake risk management, and in the same way as you would any physical hazard in the workplace. There's an obligation to keep a risk register in relation to incidents arising in the workplace that fall under these categories of unlawful conduct. And that should also, of course, be reported to the board in the usual way as you would report safety incidents. The board needs to be across these
issues. I feel like that's something all of our director clients and certainly myself sitting on boards, my ears prick up at that, because I think this just has to be on your risk register. It has to be on your agenda. And if it's not, or you're not asking the questions of management about what are we doing in this space, I think that's a critical
risk. And there's two regulators that can walk in the door now, the Australian Human Rights Commission as a regulator, and also the safety regulators can say, where is your policy? Where are your training records? Where is your risk register? What consultation was done in relation to these issues in the workplace, or in relation to the implementation of the policies or the risk register? How are you managing, controlling, eliminating these risks in the workplace? So it really is proactive. This used to be something that if there was a sexual harassment issue at work, people would, you know, there would be a complaint, there would be an investigation, but ultimately most of these matters settled. And there were, you know, few complainants would go all the way through the courts to the federal court to bring a sex discrimination matter. A couple of reasons: A, because it's a big high profile matter, it becomes a matter of public record, but also, you know, they are obviously a heavy burden, although it's balance of probabilities. It's still hard when, you know, it's a one-on-one situation. Also, finally, if you lose, or historically, if you lost, you pay the cost for the other side. That's now
sort a huge of risk to take, isn't it?
Huge risk to take. And if you don't have, like, if someone's been particularly robust or resilient in the way that they've managed it and just left the job and gone and got another job for either the same or more pay, then you don't actually have economic loss either. Mm. So a lot of these cases are not worth the cost of pursuing. They've managed that in the new legislation by saying that if the applicant wins, their costs get paid. If they lose, they only pay the respondent's costs if they've caused them to be unreasonably incurred, which is a merger of the Fair Work Act provisions and the usual common law provisions in favour of the complainants.
It's such a complex area, isn't it?
As we call them.
And I guess from a board perspective.
And those risks remain, mind you. Like, it's not that, you know, the risk of going to court and getting a $2 million claim has been eliminated. This is in addition to that.
And from that board and director perspective, is this an area in which there's personal liability potentially, similar to the work health and safety risks that we've previously dealt with?
Yeah, so to the extent that it is a work health and safety issue and there has been, and remember, it doesn't have to eventuate in damage to health and safety, it just needs to be cause a risk to health and safety, then yes, it is a directors and officers are on the hook, but also the Sex Discrimination Act, which is not criminal, has accessorial liability provisions in it. So if you know that someone, for example, has form, which is why I think a lot of boards are and leaders are acting very proactively
now. Taking a really hard line. There's a lot of exits I'm seeing.
Yeah, so many exits.
At a board director level,
90%
even in my space.
End in an exit for the perpetrator, because there is a risk that if you
know that someone's...
Yeah, that's right. And then something happens again on your watch because you've given them another chance, or, you know, you've thought, oh, look, they're a great, you know, performer, or we can't afford to lose them, or if we lose them, we lose the client, all those, you know, things that traditionally have been said or done. You know, there is a real risk of, you know, significant consequences, both from a work health and safety perspective, and under this Act you can be, you know, personally joined as an accessory if there's an order for application to the Fair Work Commission for orders to stop sexual harassment. Individuals can be named, and that would likely be the perpetrator plus perhaps others who haven't properly addressed issues, including even HR professionals. And if you breach the orders of the commission, then that results in civil penalties. And so there's a lot for our
HR professional colleagues.
Yeah, there's huge personal culpability and risk
implications
there, and it's beyond the legal, it's the reputational. Even if you don't, you know, even if you confide it, even if it's a small penalty, even, you know, it's just the fact that you know, your name's out there, or on a court transcript,
absolutely,
as well, being scrutinized about what you did or ought to have done in the circumstances.
And on that note, so from a practical perspective, what should leaders do if there is an incident in their workplace?
First and foremost, we need to have a well-documented grievance or dispute resolution procedure. That should be well-drafted to contemplate your obligations at law, but also not too prescriptive that you back yourself into a corner because you've got no flexibility and you end up in a situation where you can't comply with or fall short of some of the provisions in your overly prescriptive policy. So there is a careful balancing act, and from all the documents, it's probably one of the most critical documents to ensure you have right, and quite often I see them as an afterthought.
They've got a great policy, but no one follows it.
Then the process is just deficient. The reason why it's critical is, aside from the fact that the regulators, like I said, can call upon these documents and say, what have you done to educate your workforce about them, is it also means that if an application is made for orders to stop sexual harassment, it's a mandatory requirement for the commission to consider the processes that the organisation has in place. So far, we haven't had one run because we've been able to show up with our clients and say, this is the procedure, this is where we're up to in the procedure, we're following the process, escalation to the commission at this stage is premature. If at the end of the process the person's not satisfied, then, you know, we can come back and the commission can, you know, scrutinise our investigation and what was said or done. But at this stage, so it is really critical.
And that's a cost benefit too, I imagine, as well.
I mean, it costs very little to put a grievance procedure in place. Mm. It costs a lot of money to defend, even a stop sexual harassment matter, much less a, you know, full-blown complaint. The other thing that's important to do is, obviously, we need to have trauma-informed practices, we need to give people agency, and we need to offer EAP support to both, to everyone involved in the investigation, so not just the victim survivor, but also witnesses and the respondent. So with the witnesses or bystanders, I mean, you don't know to what extent, you know, they've been triggered by the incidents. So EAP and more specialised services should be offered depending on the nature of the incident, but also to the perpetrator, because while we, or the alleged perpetrator, I should say, because while they're still, you know, an employee, we have a work health and safety obligation to them, and it is obviously a very stressful. Albeit necessary process for them to go through. Just one last point is around legal professional privilege. We've been doing, we're engaging a lot of external investigators on behalf of our clients, on behalf of on the basis of commissioning the investigation under legal professional privilege. It's not every investigation and every matter, but depending on how serious the matter is, depending how high up the ladder it goes, depending on the complexity, the skills within the organisation, the impartiality, the people within the organisation, we, you know, so sometimes it's better to outsource the investigation, particularly where a regulator can come in and scrutinise all internal documents and ask for all internal documents to be produced. Now, at some point down the track, you know, you may decide to waive privilege to demonstrate what you've done, why you've done it, and to hand over the report to a regulator. You know, it's better to have that protection in place.
And that option.
It may also be something that's challenged, and, you know, at some point in time, someone might say, a court might decide that, no, you didn't do this for the purpose of getting legal advice. You actually conducted this investigation for the purpose of complying with your overly prescriptive policy that mandates an investigation, for example. But at the same time, a court needs to make that decision. No one can make you physically hand it over. I mean, a regulator can issue a notice and, you know, insist on it, but we've also been able to
protect those documents,
yeah, where regulators have requested them.
And also, while I think employers and companies are figuring out what they're dealing with and, you know, getting to the bottom of things and complying with those procedural fairness issues that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay, so to wrap up, by way of summary of this massive topic, what are some of the key follow-up actions for leaders in workplaces across Australia? We talked about policies and procedures, obviously training. We talk a lot in this podcast about managing reputation and risk and how our people are our human firewall in all sorts of risk and compliance areas. So what's hot topics on your to-do list for leaders in business?
I mean, everything we've spoken about, but I think in terms of key messages, I think you keep the key message that sexual harassment, victimisation, all of these things that we've been talking about are safety issues, and you treat them in the same way as you would treat a physical safety risk. So your, you know, consultation and risk management is critical. You need to educate your workforce, and that knowledge management piece is an essential building block from, like I said, from the board level down to your workers with your line managers that, like you say, being your first line of defence. Culture is critical. So the bystander action piece is really, you know, if you want to achieve transformational cultural change, that is
at all levels.
At all levels, that really has to be, you know, there needs to be empowerment. You need to build trust in the workforce. It's such a fundamental and necessary part of ensuring cultural change, but also ensuring compliance. Because if people don't trust that you will follow your policies, if they don't trust that you will not victimize them, they will not bring these complaints forward, and you will never be able to achieve the high watermark of a safe, healthy, and inclusive workplace. So you really need to ensure that, you know, where, I guess, investigate, yes, work out where the findings are substantiated. But if there are substantiated findings, it really is important that leaders act, no matter how much it might cost the business from a top line point of view. The bottom line impact of this, you know, is huge, both from a risk reputation, but also the revolving door that ensues if you don't exit, you know, perpetrators of this sort of behaviour. And I think the last message that I will leave everyone with is the culture of the organisation is ultimately shaped by the worst behaviour the leaders tolerate.
That's such an important point to finish on. And thank you so much, Faye, for sharing what is a wealth of information on this very complex and evolving topic. Thank you, everyone, for listening today. As always, please get in touch with us if you have any questions. You can find our details on our website, which is hallandwilcox.com.au, or connect with us on LinkedIn. If you enjoyed today's episode, then rate, review, or follow our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
This podcast is not legal advice and should not be relied upon as such. You should always obtain legal advice about your specific circumstances.